Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks so much. We appreciate your amazing and continued support. If you like this show, you can send it to your friends and family. If you care to rate the show, we appreciate that as well. Hey, look, thank you to our sponsors. We appreciate the hell out of them. And thanks to Tony Arterburn for hooking me up with the people over at Legal Shield. I wish I had done it sooner. Better late than never. I'll tell you what, this is a company that has been around for 50 years. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. It's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards law firms in our area. It'll get you attorneys in your area that have on average 22 years of experience. They'll be able to handle all sorts of things for you, from paperwork to traffic tickets to getting your will and testament set up, all of these things, all the things that you don't want to do, but you need to do because you're an adult. So I'll tell you what, this company's been in business 50 years. They have an A-plus rating with a Better Business Bureau, and they're available in the United States and Canada. They even, we built a website, so you can check it out for yourself, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. And what it is just, you've got access to an attorney in your area that can take care of all sorts of things. I asked this one simple question. When was the last time you updated your will? You know, a lot of people, the answer is, I don't even have a will, let alone have update anything. So do this. You got to have one. Nobody wants to think about that stuff. Nobody wants to spend money on it. They're like $1,000 for you. Maybe you've got a spouse. You're going to spend money on that. You need a medical directive, a power of attorney, a financial power of attorney. God knows, after the last couple of years, what we've seen when people get checked into hospitals and have no control over what happens to them. You've got to get this stuff done in advance. Doing it after the fact is too late. Do it now. The last thing you want to have happen is you die and then the state gets involved in your affairs through probate and you start having problems that way. Don't do that. Set your family up. At least do this. You're an adult. You've got to do it. You got to take care of this stuff. So if you need Identity Shield, they have an ID Shield component. There's a small business plan. If you're a gun owner, there's a gun ownership plan as well. There's all kinds of things. You'll never sign another legal document without sending it to your attorney first. Okay. That's what rich people do. We all know we're not attorneys, right? We know that words mean one thing to us and they mean another thing legally. All right. So you want to have your attorney take a look at anything before you sign it. If hey, and also, let's be fair. A lot of people will push you around as far as you allow them to push you, right? So if you've got some, you know, if it's work that's doing it, if you've got some sort of dispute with your homeowners association, you've got some, you know, a retail situation where you bought something and they said they would stand behind it and they didn't. And they say, well, you know, that's all, you know, too bad. Well, now you have an attorney. You can send a letter. Things get a lot different when they get an attorney letter from you. You know, it takes it to a different level. So I suggest this. Just go to the website. Take a look at what they're offering. See if it's a fit for you. Okay. That's all I ask. And if it is, pull the trigger on it. The website again, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. Check it out. See what you think. Also to our friends at Chemical Free Body, they're making the best batch of vitamins and supplements out there. I'll tell you, their stuff works. All right. They're already ahead of 95% of the people out there because their products actually work. Okay. And if they don't, if you think they don't work, well, then Tim James, the owner, has a double your money back guarantee. So look, he thinks they work. I've been through all of their programs. I take their products every single day. No exaggeration. I really honestly do. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, the detox in a box, it leaned me out in a way that was striking. You know, I had to buy new shorts. They did not fit anymore. So I'll tell you, if 2023 is the year that you decide you're finally going to get yourself healthy, you're going to make these changes, take a look. Go to chemicalfreebody.com. You see something you like, use the promo code MACRO. But just remember, look, nobody is going to get healthy for you. This is going to have to be a you solution, right? So if you think that you are going to make these changes, you're it's a new year, it's a new mentality, it's all these things, and you need a little help with some supplements, at least you'll know that the supplements work. Tim stands behind them. I'm telling you from experience, they work. It's a good product. And Pat Miletich over there has a new Super Soldier product too. I haven't tried that one yet, but he's over there. He partnered up with Tim James, a UFC Hall of Famer, Pat Miletich, to create a formula called Super Soldier that they're selling over there. So check that out while you're there. Promo code MACRO. Save yourself a little money. Of course, anything that helps to support our sponsors also helps to support the show, and we appreciate that. All right. Without further ado, now we've got the business out of the way. Let's get down to the real fun stuff. All right. The legendary Tommy Chong, ladies and gentlemen. I'm super excited today. My daughter is very excited because I am talking to Yaks, the nudist colony shopkeeper from Zootopia. Of course, I'm excited because I'm talking to Man from Up in Smoke. Of course, that means that we are talking to Tommy Chong. How are you, Tommy? Good to see you.
I'm wonderful. We've gone through our little hassles, but everything's perfect.
Do you like doing the voiceover stuff? It seems like you've done a bit of that lately.
Love it.
It's got to be so much fun.
Yeah, I like being needed, you know. It's a nice feeling, you know. We need you. I like that. And when I did the voiceover, you know, I just literally was in the hospital, after operation, and a cancer operation, and I got the call when I was in the hospital, and so when I left the hospital, my son drove me right to the studio. And we did the voice.
So, and you were needed.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, we need you. I like that. And then after I did it, I got a whole new fan base. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, it's interesting. The animated movies are so fantastic because there's one version of the story that the kids are getting. There's another version of the story that the adults are getting. And when the adults hear you, when we see Yaks coming in and looking for, you know, asking Nandi, I know who that is. My daughter doesn't know who that is. She doesn't understand the level of appreciation that I have for the voice that I'm hearing there. And she's going, oh, isn't this cute? And I'm going, you have no idea how great this is.
Yeah, it was crazy. Well, it's the same thing as when I was on Dancing with the Stars.
Right.
You know, I never intended to be on Dancing with the Stars. But what happened, my wife, who was a dancer, and she's quite ambitious, you know, with her career, and she's a really good dancer. And so she was the one that auditioned for Dancing with the Stars. But in the audition, she mentioned that she was married to me. And so then right away they go, well, not you, but how about him? You know,
right.
And of course she volunteered me. Oh yeah, he'll do it. Because she really is my boss. She's my number one advisor, and she always has been. That's
and you guys have been together for what, 45 years or so?
Oh, even longer, but yeah. She doesn't like to take it any more than that in the number thing.
Okay, well, 20 years, huh? Amazing, you and her.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So then I auditioned. You know, they wanted to talk to me, and they would have taken me no matter what, you know, because of the name.
Yeah.
But what shocked a lot of people was the fact that I could dance.
I know. I know you. I saw the Roy Wood Jr. This Isn't Happening, where you're talking about you're doing the explanation where you're in the strip club, you know, the open mic sort of setup. You're telling the story of your the raid on your house and how you go before the judge and you explain to the judge that you were trying to teach kids salsa dancing to keep them off of drugs. That's a great one right there. So I know you know how to dance.
Yeah. Well, the reason I learned was because of my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a loner. You know, she does things. She's way advanced. She's a very fine artist, and she has that artist mind, and she sees the future. Always has. And so, Cheech and I had broken up. I was like floundering around trying to think of what I was going to do next, you know. And then I was eventually got into stand up, you know, which took all the time. But she was bored, so she started ballroom dancing, and at first, you know, I had the thought of ballroom dancing just, you know, I didn't want to any part of it. And then she ended up meeting a salsa teacher, and next thing you know, she's not going ballroom, she's going dancing, salsa dancing, you know, little short skirt, right. Hair uh-huh. All looking good.
Yeah.
Look great. And I said, where are you going? Oh, I'm going salsa dancing. Do you want to come? Well, I don't know how to dance salsa. She's, well, why don't you pick me up after the dance? And so I said, okay. You know, because we had always been because she had been my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So we always had that connection, you know, with each other. And so I showed up at the salsa club, you know, it wasn't quite finished. And she's standing in the middle of the floor with other dancers, and she's holding hands with the teacher. And you know, I'm a little jealous, and right away I thought, hey, just a minute here, you know. And she saw me, and she kind of gave me a hi, and but she didn't drop the guy's hand, you know. She kept mm-hmm. holding his hand, and then she walked over and kind of introduced me, and I was, you know, again, I was like, this. Okay, it's a little more than just ballroom, you know.
Right.
And so then her teacher, the guy that she was holding hands with, he got off to do a show, and he needed a partner. And so she was all excited. I'm going to, you know, we're going to do the show, and you'll have to come down. And of course, I'm going to come down.
Right. Yeah, better now.
I drove down. And again, she's all excited about dancing. She's looking gorgeous, and the music starts, and she, her and Nestor look in each other in the eye, you know, very theatrical, but when it's your old lady, man, when it's your girl, she's not looking at you like that, you know?
Right.
And so right away, my mouth is dry, my heart's pounding, you know? And then at the end of the dance, he flips her upside down and her dress comes down and her, these beautiful legs are sticking straight up in the air. I mean, it was the sexiest, most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And so after that night, you know, then after, you know, the show ends and she comes over, so what do you think? I got to talk to your teacher. So I went over to Nestor and I said, Nestor, teach me. You show me how to do this dance. He said, I'd love to. He says, I'll tell you what, why don't you come on the cruise? We're doing a salsa cruise. And so, and it was like not only a salsa cruise, but it was like a meet and greet, you know, get a mix, you know,
right,
get together. And it's out of San Diego to Puerto Vallarta and that. Mm-hmm. So I told Shelby and she said, great. You know, it's not like she was going to come. She didn't want to come. She said, oh, yeah. Oh, that's great. Go have fun. And so they even put me, because I'm Chinese, they put me in with a Chinese girl, you know, a single.
Right.
It was, they were like, that's what it was. But, you know, I'm an old married man, you know, and I just wanted to go there to learn salsa. And so Nestor and I, we became very good friends and we just danced the whole time we were there. I learned, I knew how to Lindy Hop and jive, and I knew, and cha-cha. I knew a lot of the black street dancers. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I really was. My first wife was black, and that's since I was like 14, 15 years old. I was going to black clubs and black dancing. You know, that was always in my blood. And so we went to Mexico, and I learned how to dance salsa. And then I learned something very interesting about dancing. Is that, you know, it's never a good idea for a husband and wife to dance with each other because they got too much history.
Mm.
And dancing is much like horseback riding. You know, if the rider doesn't know how to ride, the horse knows it immediately.
Right. Right. You know? My daughter's a horseback rider and she has that same issue where she gets on a horse that if she doesn't show competence and confidence, that horse feels it, feels it somehow and reacts accordingly.
Yeah. And that's the same as dancing, you know? And so not dancing with your wife or dance with strangers. I mean, that is something that, that is still, it's going on now, you know, because after the salsa, my salsa world, and then I just went salsa dancing by myself or with a friend. And then I would meet my wife later because she would go to another club with her friends. And then we'd either hook up later or just at home. And so I became a salsa crazed. And I got good enough. Well, then I got on Dance with the Stars. Right. Because dancing anything, it's like stand-up comedy or anything. You learn basics.
Mm-hmm.
And for dancing, it's posture and knowing the step. It's like acting. Yeah. You know your lines, know who you are, know your character and everything. And so the dancing became a very serious part of my life. Not the performing part, but the exercises that you need to do in order to dance.
Yeah.
Like right now as an exercise, because I'm getting up there and I can feel it. And so being in I'm in my middle 80s now.
Yeah.
I don't have the same kind of energy that I had when I was at 60 even, you know. Your body, like an old car, it starts, you know, moving slower and needing more rest. But what it does, the tango. And that's what I told the judge, because in order to lighten up my sentence, I did some community work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the work one of the things I did was I taught a class at Chapman College in Orange County.
Yeah.
And what it was a salsa thing, because what I realized, so many Latinos in America, they lost touch with their roots, you know.
Yeah.
And salsa is well, it came from mambo. That's where the dance came from. It was called the mambo. And by the way, all the dances, including tango, salsa, especially the waltz, all that, came from Africa.
Mm.
Did you know that?
No. Yeah. I mean, I knew it had a black sort of Caribbean vibe to it, but I didn't take it back further than that.
Well, that's where it's from. It's from, all from Africa. Tango itself, the dance itself, is a mating dance that the tribes, I think, in the Congo or somewhere deep in Africa, the teenagers of the tribes get together and they do this dance, much like it was dance with the feet, doing tricks with the feet, and flirting with the feet with your mm-hmm. partner, and was the black sailors that were sailing around the world. They would go into port. And they would go to the brothels, and they'd hire the hookers to dance with them. And then they taught them how to dance the tango. They taught them the tango, and that's where the first tango dancers, like even in Buenos Aires, were black, from Africa, you know, ex slaves and that. Right. And then the Spanish and everybody else, the Argentinians came in, and then they had to study it. But it was, and tango is such a, it still is a mating dance.
Right.
The rules of tango and everything else, and salsa, they're very close, but tango especially, because tango is really hard to do. Because the guy has to know exactly what the girl is doing, and the girl has to be able to respond to what the guy wants, but she doesn't have to if she doesn't want to, but she can just do her own thing. Mm. But you have to know there's steps. In fact, I got a book, it's like a dictionary, and it's about all the steps that the tango dancers use. And I didn't know any of them when I first started.
Right.
And the reason I started dancing tango was we got offered a movie when Cheech and I were together. We got offered, well, the Corsican Brothers, which we did. And then the next one was going to be the Siskel Kid. And in the Siskel Kid, they had a tango scene.
And so
when I saw the tango scene, and I was living in Paris at the time, and we used to drive by this dance studio where it said Tango with George and Rosie. And so my wife and I stopped in there, and that was our first little shot at the tango world. And I've been in it ever since, you know.
Did your music, because your background is in music, of course. Yeah. And I'm assuming that had something to do with this, right? You have you mentioned that you grew up very involved with the black community. You had a couple black guys in the band with you, right? So you come out of the music that makes perfect sense for me. Music, dance. What doesn't, where it loses me is music, stand-up comedy. You know what I mean?
The funniest people on the planet are jazz musicians.
Mm.
Every jazz musician has a joke that will. They're known for it. They're phenomenal because jazz is all about taking a theme and then changing it to either fast, slow, whatever you feel. But you take the basics of the song and then you rework it into creating a brand new song. Mm-hmm. See, jazz musicians, they learn changes. And that's what I learned coming up, you know, as a blues. It's kind of like the blues. Blues are the blues. But right. If you get a jazz guy playing the blues, oh my God, that's when you get incredible music, you know. But yeah, it's what comedy is too. There is a definite framework for comedy, and music falls into the same thing, and drama falls into the same thing, acting falls into that same thing. You know, it's all about timing.
Yeah, yeah. And well, you mentioned that your wife is artistic, but you know, I knew you wrote the Cheech and Chong movies. I never knew you directed them, though.
Yeah,
you got to be artistic to do that. How do you have? I mean, for lack of a better word, the audacity to think you could be a director, to step in there and direct. Now, I watched those movies. I was born in 72. First one came out in 70. You went from 78 to 84. So you're talking about, for me, I'm like 6, 7, all the way to 12, 13. That's my prime. You know, you turn on the movie channel or HBO late at night. If you had Up in Smoke or Next Movie, you knew you were in for a good night, right? So those are the movies that I watched. Those movies as a kid, I've watched those movies as an adult. There's no, you're as good of a director as anybody I've ever watched. How did you know that you could direct those movies?
I play music by ear. I still don't know how to read music. I know the theory behind it. I know my notes and everything else. If someone yells, chords changes to me. I know just from playing with good musicians, you know. And that also, that lack of formal training also helped me with directing a movie. Mm. Because I got involved in improvisational comedy. Or acting, like the Second City and the Committee and people like that.
Right.
When I was on the road with Motown, instead of going to a blues club, because blues, there's blues, you know, they're good, they're bad, whatever. It's usually an excuse to get, have fun, relax, let your hair down, meet people, blah, blah, blah. But when I started going to this, I went in by accident, but my life is very serendipity. It was like I was steered into this. You know, I was in San Francisco, never had any money. We were there. In fact, we were down in L.A. We tried to find a gig in L.A. and we never. And so we're coming back and we met a singer at Big Al's nightclub. And he got us a gig playing one night a week at Big Al's. Mm-hmm. So that the band that was playing there could have a night off. Because up until then, they were playing seven nights a week.
Oh, jeez.
It was like packed in there. And so I had a chance to live in San Francisco, work one night a week, and hang out on the strip the rest of the time.
Right.
Because I never had any money. And if I did, I wouldn't spend it on, you know, anything. But for some reason, I found enough money, just a couple of bucks, to see the Committee. And I went and see it, and it was all actors, and they're improvisational acting. Right. And the first bit they did put me on the floor. It was, they're having a surprise party for this old guy who's coming in. He's about to retire, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a surprise party. So all the actors come in, they sneak around, they're hiding in town. Oh, he's coming. They're all excited. And then he walks in the door, and they go, surprise! And he drops dead.
Right.
He holds his heart.
Right. A Fred Sanford.
Yeah, the surprise killed him. That was the start of my love for improvisational comedy. And I managed to go there, I don't know how many times. I become quite a regular. And then being a musician, and playing by ear, I could pick up. I just learned recently that Bob Dylan, it's the same way. He's got perfect pitch. He's got a photographic memory. And he really didn't know how to read or write music. But he could remember, he could hear a tune once and remember it. And you develop that after a while with, when you're playing music, you develop the ability to hear notes and to hear, you know, separation and that. And so I could remember the bits, you know. Gotcha. And so then when I had a chance, I turned a family-owned strip club into a improvisational comedy club, using the strippers as the actresses instead of, because the improv clubs had girls, but they were really good actresses, and for the most part, they never did anything sexual. Mm. It was all wife or something, you know. But here I had a strippers,
right?
and they're dealing with horny guys every night, and or drunks, and
or both.
They ended up being the best actresses. The strip club acting thing was incredible. It was just incredible, because we had this and what I do, and this is part of my directing skills, was that I learned how to use the energy, the innocent energy, where there people aren't expecting, when they're expecting one thing, but you give them another thing,
right?
Because it's a stage, you can do whatever you want, you know. And so when we started the strip club improvisational comedy thing, we made up our own rules. There was really no rules.
Right. Know? Yeah, great.
And the only rules that I really, end with music, you know, just end a bit with music and you're good to go. And so and that's how I got, ended up meeting Cheech, because I had real actors.
Yeah.
You know. When you start a theater thing like that, there are actors come out of the woodwork, you know. And actors are like musicians too. No money.
Right. A lot of time.
A lot of time. No money. A lot of talent. No money. And what do they attract? People with a lot of intelligence, but very little money. And what money they have, they count their change, you know. Well, when the strip club, now what it is, it's a place where they can throw their money away.
Yes.
Because they got so much, they worked hard, the loggers or the miners or whatever it was, they worked hard all the months that they were in the bush, you know, and now they're coming out. What are they going to spend? They don't need anything. They already got a job and a place to live and sleep and everything. So they got all this cash, you know, and so they come down and they give it to all the strippers and the guys and and people rob them and everything else. But actors, and so when I turned the strip club into a improvisational club, we got the crowd, but we lost money. We had 20 drunk bikers can keep a club alive for years, you know.
Right.
But 300 theater goers will break a club,
put you into bankruptcy.
Yeah, in a couple of months. But the good news is that Cheech and I, when we got Cheech, Cheech was like the third party. I had another partner named Dave, but everybody in the strip club, all the strippers included, this was just a little diversion from their life, you know, because a lot of strippers had problems, you know, heroin, you know,
right.
Junkies and all sorts of problems that you can imagine they would have.
Of course, yeah.
But the acting, but that's how I got the acting, and that's how I got really the directing too, because directing bits for bikers, say, that don't know what's happened, you know, that was perfect for the movie industry, because what you want to do is you want to create something on stage that people are going to know, are so amazed at the comedy and at the at whatever you're giving them, that they will excuse all the amateurish, if there is any. But what I learned, when you're in a strip club, you don't have a lot of leeway, you know. You either hit that note and they're going to laugh at you, or move on, buddy, because yeah. you don't have any, a chance to explain
yeah.
your vision.
Nobody's yeah. interested. In the, did you craft that man character from the bikers that you ran into in those bars? Because you were in the films, you were essentially a biker, you know?
Yeah. Well, it was a mix. Like the bikers that I knew, they're no humor whatsoever. You know, they're dangerous. They're like right. having a rattlesnake in your room. You know?
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you don't know when they're going to flip and punch you. They'll punch you for no reason.
Right.
You know, and then if you punch them, they'll understand. You know, that weird thing. No. One day, I was after we got the club. You got the club all set up. I changed it over, you know, and I had there's a little light booth. It was a dinner club before I took it. So we had a little light booth area for the light booth and that. And I was walking down the street, and Vancouver was on a garbage strike. Every once in a while, Canada, weird, you know, so the garbage was piled up high in big black garbage bags. And I walked, and it was kind of snowing, a light snow coming down. And there was this hippie with red hair, and his hair flowed out like this here. It looked like a Dickens character, you know, with the overcoat, the hair. And his name was, I asked him, what's your name? He said, Strawberry. That was his name. And Strawberry said to me, hey, man. Do you know where I could crash tonight? And I looked at him and I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. Oh, that's cool, man. I said, I got a nightclub and you can sleep in there. Oh, that'd be great, man. Hey, thanks. So Strawberry became our light man because he's in the light booth.
Right.
And he was the funniest light man because he's no theater experience, but one of those natural street guys, you know, and street guys, they can chameleon in a minute, you know, they got so much knowledge because yeah. that's where they're on the street.
Yeah.
And so Strawberry, we would do bits and then Cheech joined the ranch, you know, and we'd need a blackout and Strawberry would be slow on the uptake, you know, and we're all frozen and Cheech would yell, Strawberry, lights. Strawberry, looking somewhere else. You know. It's a beautiful character. And if we did a bit that didn't work and we come backstage, Strawberry would get us and say, oh, man, that was the worst, man. Oh, that sucked, man. That bit really sucked, man. And so when I was looking for a character, because when we did Up in Smoke, in my mind, I said, I wanted to play the opposites. So Cheech was a lowrider, Chicano woman. Mm-hmm. I became Strawberry, basically, you know.
Gotcha.
And it's like the voice of truth. Hey, man, you know, are you Mexican? Wow. Right. That character. And as far as directing goes, because I was in all the skits
yeah.
and at the same time, you know, there was no pressure. See, the only pressure was how hard can you get these guys laughing? That was the only pressure.
Mm-hmm.
It was because it was a surprise. And then we built a crowd, but they weren't paying any money, you know, but we got quite a following, you know, and I kind of knew we were on to something because in the nightclub business, there's hustlers. You know, they use the club as an office.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great, but they're hustlers and they're scam artists and they're con men. That's your office, you know, because everything is in the nightclub world. It's kind of make believe. You know, you got music that drowned out, you know, and then you got beautiful girls and waiting on you, and it's all about money. They're yeah. trying to make money. You've got money, you're giving it away, you know, and so there's a nice little mix in there. But reality is a lot of a lot of the girls got a drug habit. They got hurt, some pimp old man or something. There's some weird shit going on. Every once in a while, there'd be like a real housewife just getting by and doing her thing, you know? And so my directing was really my couple of training. When I started playing guitar, my first gig, really, I was 8, 9 years old, and the fiddle player across the field from us, his guitar player moved, got a job, and moved out of the city. And I was the only guy that he knew that could play the songs that he was playing. And so I got drafted into the rhythm guitar section of the dance.
And really? At 9?
At 9 years old, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so I played the parties, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really connected with my dad.
Mm.
Because before that, I was like the middle child. My older brother, Stan, he was also named after my dad. He was number one son. And he was 3 years older than me and strong and good everything. I was the, you know, come on, man. They got tired of waiting for me. I was always slower than everybody.
Right.
And but when I started playing music, I became important. Then my dad really respected that part of it. And he would drive me like, you know, in the country, you break a guitar string, where are you going to go?
Right.
You know? And so I broke a guitar string, and my dad, the next day, was it would drive me right into town, and we'd always buy one guitar string. I crack up now because it was like a 10 cents.
Right.
And so you have your dime, put your dime down, get your one guitar string. It's E string. You're going to break it again, you know.
Right. You should get a couple. Just save us a trip. But
my ability and what happens, that was my training. That's the fiddle player. It's a keep it simple. That was it. Keep it simple. In other words, don't get fancy with the backbeat. Just give that comp some, you know. And then it was like, give the people what they want, you know. They would request the same song maybe 5, 6 times a night, and he'd play it. And he told me, yeah, give the people what you want. Keep it simple. Give the people what they want, you know?
Yeah.
And make them happy, you see? It was. And when you play for dancing, it's a cause and effect. It's because of you that you got all these people happy and dancing and everything else.
Yeah.
And so when I was never a leader of a band. I was always the backup guitar player for a singer. And you know, when Elvis hit, then my friend, which is, he was a native, full-blood Sarsi native from Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like Elvis impersonator. You know, he had acne and black hair, but he'd put up his collar up and do the Elvis. Yeah. Impersonation, girls would go nuts. It was like crazy. And so that was my first entertainment experience, you know. And then eventually we opened for some, you know, fairly pop stars, you know, because in Calgary or any of those markets, you use the local band, you know, to open the shows, right. For
yeah
like that open for like Roy Orbison and
nice
people like that, you know.
That's great.
But what I learned, it was a discipline of playing music that people could dance to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my thing. And then when I got older, I developed a social consciousness, and it started off first with the Rebel Without a Cause. Remember that right. Movie?
Yeah.
It started off with that attitude of James Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And his father didn't understand him. All he wanted was just to be noticed, you know, be loved. And he was just, you know, Natalie Wood.
Yeah.
I just watched a show on Natalie. And Sal Mineo. I met Sal Mineo. In fact, Sal was involved when we won a teen fair. We won a contest, a band, and we had a recording contract was the prize, and Sal Mineo was hired to give out the prize. So I met the Rebel Without a Cause had a big influence on my life.
Yeah.
Big influence. Way I looked, you know, the way I acted. And back then, this is what I learned too just recently. I remember, you know, because I'm at that stage now, it cracks me up that I used to hear old guys when they got my age, they would say, "Oh, when I was a kid, I had to walk a mile to school." And through I had to walk a mile to school.
You like really did in Calgary, huh?
It was my life. It was my life. And so now I'm kind of in that mode, you know, I get to talk about my life. Because when they say, you know, how come you did what you did? Because no schooling at all, except practical, you know, learning on the job. That's what I learned, you know. It wasn't if I studied hard, I could learn, I could become this, I could become that, or whatever. One time in my life, I was jonesing for a job where I could wear a suit and tie, mm-hmm. because all the jobs that I had were manual labor kind of things, you know. And I realized that, you know, especially when you play music, you know, you like dressing up nice, and you don't like to do heavy labor shit, you know, which I was never good at. And so I tried, and I found a job where I wore a suit and tie. And again, I used to like, when you're unemployed in Canada, you go to the unemployment office and they'll find you a job, because Canada was always looking for workers, mm-hmm. you know, and it was always shit jobs. Yeah. You know, they say, "Oh, hey, we got a job at the cookie factory," right. And so part of my early training was all these weird jobs that I had that I really enjoyed, until I realized it was, you know, you're not going to go any further than this, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and because I was a musician, that's the other thing I did. Becoming a musician, you end up hanging out with other unemployed musicians, and so if one of us got a job, which was usually me, because, you know, in my family there's no such thing as laying around the house,
right?
If you were out of work, what are you doing home? Out of work, well, why aren't you at the unemployment office getting another job? Because right. that's the way it was. And so I got a job at the sugar cookie factory. That was where the unemployment sent me down to the cookie factory, and it was like I was like a slave labor, you know.
Right.
I made icing for a while, and then they had me. Yeah, they'd move me around where they need a young guy with energy,
right.
and ability. But when I got the band, when we put the band together, everybody needed a job. And the cookie factory hired all of us.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And it was, I'll have to do a movie one time because it was funny. The big Indian Elvis impersonator.
Yeah.
He ended up with a job taking the cookies out of the oven and putting on a conveyor belt. But because he never had the rhythm, the cookies would fall on the floor because they're coming out of an oven. You can't keep them in the oven. And so you put them somewhere, and they piled up. They would pile up on the floor, and you couldn't stop anything.
It's like a Lucille Ball skit, you know.
That's what it was. And Tommy Milton, the black singer of the group, because I started a group when I started with Dick Bird. It was just Dick and I, and then I met Tommy. He was a star football player, but he could sing. But more than any, he could dance. And so when Dick and I would sing, Tommy would get a partner and dance mm-hmm. at the Legion Halls and that. And it was a great show. And then Tommy started singing rhythm and blues. And so we called ourselves the Shades, because there was Dick, an Indian, myself, half Chinese, and Tommy, a black Canadian.
Variations of color.
Yeah, we were the rare medium and well done. And, and the Shades became a very, very influential, rhythm and blues band out of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And we went up to Edmonton. We played up in Edmonton one time. And then we owned Calgary, basically. Every venue that was there, we owned it. Because we not only sang, but we did tricks. You know, my brother ended up playing bass because we needed a car.
Not because they can play bass, but because we needed a car.
And when we had a reunion, we're at the reunion, and in the interim, you know, 20, 30 years went by, you know, my brother couldn't come on the road with us when we got fired. We got kicked out of Calgary. My brother had to stay because he had kids, and he wasn't a bass player, you know. And so this other kid, black kid, followed us around everywhere we went. He was a singer. And so I told him, I says, learn how to play bass. And he says, okay. Became one of the best bass players in Alberta. And Wes. And so it was Wes and myself. And we, I thought Wes was kind of going to be a partner of mine. He was younger than me. But it didn't work out that way. You know, not too many people trusted me.
No.
You know, they would.
They do now. You know.
Well, even now.
But you've got that, you know, you've got the reputation. I'm curious though, like, because like you've got singing background or, you know, musician background, comedy, stand up, you know how to put a show together. You can kind of see it in your head, how this is all going to work. You've been working these bits. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that probably the movie making process, was it as fun? Because it's so choppy, and you're filming the last scene first and the middle scene second, and all this stuff is out of order. But in a live presentation, in a live performance, you get that instant hit of like laughter and all of this, and you know that everything is working. When you guys are filming when you're filming Up in Smoke, the first one, did you have any idea how funny it was going to be? I mean, or was it one of these things that you're like, well, let's see what it looks like in post-production when they edit it all together? And
No. We didn't know anything about post or anything about that. No, all we knew. See, what happened was that we had a live show and we were doing records. And Lou Adler, our record producer, he was very happy with our act because we'd go on the road, make a shitload of money, and he would sell a shitload of records. And what happened? We kept going to Australia. And the first time was exciting. The second time was, it's okay. The third time, because what happens when you went to Australia, you missed winter, summer. Mm. You missed summer here in America. And you got winter over there. And then when you finish there, you come back in time for winter here. And so we did three years of winter. And I got tired. And in the meantime, I had met a filmmaker, a scriptwriter, and he was a Tai Chi expert. He was teaching us Tai Chi. And so I started writing a movie with him. And so when it was time to go to Australia, I told Lou and Cheech, you know, I says, you know, I don't want to go to Australia. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, make a movie. And so Lou Adler right away goes, oh, okay, let me make a deal because I know all the movie guys.
Right.
And so he went on the beach and he made it. He made a deal with Paramount. He did it. Lou is a brilliant business.
Oh, yeah.
And so
he's been around forever, too.
Yeah. We started putting this movie together, you know, but it was weird because there was really no script. And what we were doing, we were trying to put the components together, you know. I was a great admirer of Robert Altman. you know, I loved all his movies and that. And little did I realize that my earliest training was movies. Dating a girl, you know, I'd take her to the movies.
Right.
The cheapest, the drive-in theater with my dad, the family, you know, in the car. And you can make your own popcorn and you can sit in. And so it was movies, always movies. And when I was a real young kid, we were put into the afternoon movies where they had all the Bowery Boys shorts and all that. I grew up literally in a movie theater watching all the early movies, Charlie Chaplin and everything. And then I got into reading biographies. And one thing, Charlie Chaplin really hit me with this, his biography, you know, because the guy was a fine musician, incredible actor, and everything was great. But he picked that tramp character because it was one character that everybody could look down on. And so then when we decided that it was going to be Up in Smoke, and the way we did that, Lou had these other guys trying to come in to be a director, and we'd meet with them, and they had their own life, you know, and they had their own ideas what they wanted to do. And so we nixed every one of them. And then one day I took some time off and I wrote a song. I wrote Up in Smoke. And then I took it to, and I played it for Lou and Cheech. And when Cheech heard it, he goes, that's our movie. That's the title of our movie, Up in Smoke. And then once we had the title, then we decided the characters. Cheech and I decided, well, it'd be Pedro and Man, you know, our go-to characters. Mm-hmm. Now, Cheech had a cousin, Louie, who was a writer. And so we had Louie come in, and Louie and Cheech and I decided that I decided that the character would be opposites. Cheech was from the ghetto, mm-hmm. and then I would be from a upper Jewish home, you know,
right?
From a good home, and Cheech is from the barrio,
right?
And then we get together, and so the movie starts off with me, you know, being told to get a job, and then the other thing I want to do is be one of those failure to launch kids.
Yeah,
he's 40 years old, living at home, and he's a drummer, sort of.
Right.
And I love that. I love that part. And then Cheech wrote everything. And so what we did, we got the characters, and then we just wrote the scenarios for the, once we had the scenario, then as far as the dialogue goes, it was easy because my character would react more than act.
Yes. Yeah. And there was a lot of physical comedy, the, there's the revving the motorcycle and all of this stuff. There's a lot of, you know, it might not look like, it might not take up a lot of pages in terms of dialogue.
Well, yeah.
But there was action there.
And that was a great thing because we weren't slave to the written word. Mm-hmm. See, when you do movies in Hollywood, first of all, you get the script. It's got to be the book or the script. You know, then you get these guys that are, you know, the made shitload of money writing scripts. And they're pros. And when they're pros, they know that if they write certain things in there, you know, that their job is going to be secure, you know. In other words, they don't mind spending money. Mm-hmm. They don't mind spending money. Well, we're from a different, Cheech and I, we're from a whole different thing. It was go on stage, do your bit, and then get off the stage, you see. And so the movie was basically the same thing. So we would do a bit, and a lot of the bits we made up on the spot, you know, because, okay, we need a bit here. Okay, you know. And or we'd be having lunch or something, and Cheech would tell a story, a very funny story, about him getting drunk and coming home and peeing in the hamper instead of in the toilet.
Right.
And so I got to put it in.
Sure.
And the great thing, because Lou Adler, who is now the director, was just listening to me. You know, he'd listen, boom, okay, and he'd tell everybody what had to be done. And then actors like Stacy Keach or Struthers Martin and that, they were so pro and such good improv actors that when we freed them, I mean, if anything was a problem of them doing too much, you know, Stacy.
He was great in it because he was this buttoned up, straight-laced guy.
Yeah.
And the butting up against you guys that were not, I mean, Sergeant Stadenko is in my head to this day. He's such an unusual character that I remember watching that thinking, this is hysterical. I mean, as an adult watching it, I think this is hysterical. Yeah. The juxtaposition between these guys and this straight. And Stacy Keach was well known, right? At the time, like that's like a big name guy to have in your movies.
Big time. I had main actors turn me down. Not mean, but the committee types. Mm-hmm. See, when I tried to make peace with the committee because, we literally stole a lot of their bits. Not really stole. We redid them, our way. We didn't Cheech and Chong. And next thing you know, what came out of the committee ended up on the Cheech and Chong album. And a lot of the committee understood and welcomed it. But there was main guys that really, they were like disgusted at the fact that, a couple of guys like Cheech and Chong would come in and swoop their whole thing and then end up doing a movie. But I offered all those guys a part in the movie, and they all, a lot of them turned it down because now he wants us to be in their movie, but Stacy, he's an improv actor, as good as he is with the scripts and everything else, he can go off on his own and create like anything. He created that whole character. Now, there was a real Stadenko, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. There was a cop in Vancouver that used to bust the hippies in my club I had. It was Abe Stadenko. And so when we wrote the character, I said, we got to put Abe in there. So this guy, this narc that used to torture us in Vancouver, put friends of mine in jail for a bag of weed, stuff like that. They're way behind, now. But he got so famous because of the movie that they shipped him off to Turkey. he spent the last part of his career in Turkey. And then when he came back to Vancouver, he became like the cop that would hang around. There was really nothing for him to do because he was so out of the loop. And I got a call from the narcs in Calgary, who were all big fans by then. They're all big Cheech and Chong fans, and they loved the fact that they knew Abe Stadenko. And so they're giving them a farewell party because they had to retire his ass so he'd get out of the office. And as a surprise, they got a poster from me and Cheech signed to Abe Stadenko, because Abe Stadenko's name is on the poster. Stacy Keach as Abe Stadenko.
Oh, really? Oh, my God. That's even funnier.
Crazy. And so the narcs called me, and I'm talking. He's telling me, this so-and-so from Narcotics in Vancouver. He said, it's not a business call. He said, don't worry. And he told me, we want you to sign it and send us an Abe Stadenko poster. And so we did. And I said, how did Abe take it? And they said, not too well.
That's great. I fully thought that Stacy Keach in character as Sergeant Stadenko was going to testify against you in your trial. He would have been, that gentleman there pissed on my leg in 1982 at a urinal. throw the book at him. How funny, man.
Oh, I love it. And Stacy and I really, it was a mutual admiration society with all those actors and that, because Lou Adler was, you know, the director walking around with the director's hat and all that. But I was the guy that was writing the shit, you know, and they knew it. Everybody knew it. And so they were coming to me. And the truth is, I've told this story many times. Cheech hates this story. I don't know why either. What happened was after we got close to the end of the movie, by the way, we shot it in less than 2 months.
And, wow.
Yeah. And under budget, we
what was the budget?
It ended up something like $700,000-$800,000.
Okay, in 1978 it came out. So you're filming it in 77, maybe
70? Yeah,
yeah,
okay. Yeah, all 77. Now the problem was that Cheech and I stopped having income, you know, because we stopped our live show,
right?
And we had never gotten paid for the Up in Smoke movie. Like it was we hadn't decided, and Lou had tried to sneak some contracts in on us. But I'm really sweet, but I'm not stupid, you know. And I felt that pressure, you know, sign, and I said no, I wouldn't do it. And then no, what they wanted me to do is get our own lawyer. And I said, well, you're my lawyer. Why do we need a lawyer? You know, mm-hmm. you're the ones that we trust. You know, that's your job. And what they were doing, they were stealing the movie, basically. Oh. And so when it came down to the end, Lou decided to make the move, you know. And so I was kind of banned from the set. You know, I was. They needed me every day, and all of a sudden, oh, what's going on? Oh, they're shooting something. How come I'm not there? Well, Lou says, you don't need to be there. And so what it was, Lou had written a new ending. With Lou Lombardo on that. So they did an ending they wanted to surprise me with. And I says, okay, I was happy for that. You know, good. Let's see what you got. Well, their ending was so bad. What it was that, you know, that thing at PCH where we do all the getting stopped and
yeah.
All of a sudden we're back there. And Stacy Keach is in a cop uniform now, and he's looking in the window. And what they were trying to do is saying that this was all a dream.
Oh, gotcha.
Right there. And you talk about stopping the momentum.
Yeah.
In the movie, you know, like fucking horrible. It got to the point, I haven't really recovered from that.
Really? You know?
My attitude toward Lou and to everybody. See, I trust everybody. You know, yeah. I trust everybody. And to me, you know, why would you steal? You don't have to steal. You know, just tell me what do you need, and we'll do it. But when you try to steal a movie that, you know, because you want to be the director of choice and all that shit, you know. And the thing was, it was stupid. The way it was, we could have, we had a chance, because what happened, this is the way everything's serendipity. I don't worry about anything because I'm so well protected, you know, because I'm so well connected. Oh, I like that. So well protected because I'm so well connected.
You're connected.
Yeah, so that when it came time to shoot the ending, and so then everybody came over to me. So what's the new ending? I said, I can't tell you. I have to direct it.
Mm.
And so I took over the directing thing for the ending, which was very simple. We're just driving down PCH, and we're celebrating the fact that we just did a concert, that we kicked ass, everything's fine. And I lit up a little bit of hash on a needle, and I smoked it, and then I dropped it somewhere. She said, you give me a hit of that. And he, what happened, man? And, oh, shit. And then his balls started burning, and then he started being, and then the things filled up with smoke. And then Up in Smoke plays, and the car goes down the street, and we're on to the next adventure.
Yeah.
See, that's what, and when I realized.
Perfect setup for next movie, too.
When I realized that Lou, all he wanted to do was just have one movie and have an ending, wrap it up, and this is my movie. And then, you know what I mean? There was, being a manager, that's why those guys don't make good writers, because they don't have the imagination. Right. All they can see is what's in front of them. And if what's in front of them is money that no one else is grabbing, they'll grab it, you see. And so when I, after that, you know, then our whole thing went really serious, you know, because now we had nothing, no future, nothing. Right. We couldn't get a meeting, because everybody thought Lou Adler was the director, and even the ending and everything else, no one gave me any credit for that. Right. And all the insiders knew, but as far as the world goes, it was a Lou Adler movie. And so the all the brass and everything else. And then Lou's cousin, who also got kind of screwed over by Lou Marshall, he introduced me to this hustler friend of his that he met. And enter Howard Brown, thanks to Marshall Blonstein. And Howard Brown came in, and we became friends. I loved Howard. He's like a Jewish gangster from New York. Mm-hmm. And I loved that guy. Loved everything about him. We'd call him Suits, because he always was immaculate with a suit. And he used to be a real handsome guy at one time, but he had a habit of rubbing his nose, and so his nose got big. But what a beautiful, beautiful person he was. Except Cheech did not trust him, did not like him.
Oh.
To this day. In fact, we just did a documentary. And part of the documentary, the Cheech and Chong documentary, I asked Cheech, I said, in the show, why didn't you like Howard? And he said, Howard Brown's a thief. I said, Howard Brown saved us from Lou Adler. Howard Brown got us three movies. We couldn't get a meeting with anybody. Howard said, listen, I know these guys. You know, I know Ned Tannen. I know. He says, let me make your next deal for you. He says, what do you want? I said, well, you know, if you get us $1 million, you know, that in fees, you know, we can work with that, you know. And he said, okay. He goes off, and, you know, there's a restaurant, it used to be Hamburger Hamlet on Sunset in Doheny. Mm-hmm. And so Howard says, go to Hamburger Hamlet, and I'll call you after the meeting, let you know how it went. And so the meeting was at noon. So I'm sitting in my Hamburger Hamlet, you know, waiting.
Just waiting.
Yeah, and Howard phones up. He says, okay. Good news. We got a deal. I said, yeah, it's great. He says, got what you wanted, the million and fees. And no, it's actually $1 million each. So it was $2 million in fees. And then whatever the budget is, whatever the script, we'll budget that. And he says, I said, great. Okay, let me phone Cheech. He said, no, wait, just a minute. He says, I had the meeting only took 20 minutes. He said, I had my suit on. And so I phoned Frank Price over at Columbia. And so here's the deal. Okay, we got the movie with Ned Tannen. He says, okay, Columbia. Okay, here's your deal. I couldn't ask for $2 million, you know, so I had to ask for more. So you're going to do another movie for Columbia. This time you get $3 million to split, you know. And I'm going, oh, but great. Well, let me pull a cheat. He said, no, wait, there's more. I said, what? Howard? Okay. He says, you got two movies that Columbia wants you to do, the next two. Tannen gets one, Columbia gets two. And here's the deal. You're going to go in and you're going to tell them, give them three stories, and they're going to pick the one they like. And in order to do that, you each get $50,000 just to show up at the meeting.
Jesus.
Howard was good, man.
Howard. And was that next movie Nice Dreams and Things Are Tough All Over?
Well, next movie was Universal.
Okay.
That was the Universal for the two. And then Nice Dreams and Things Are Tough All Over.
And then Still Smoking went afterwards?
No, well, Still Smoking was with Paramount.
Okay.
See, Paramount, there again, Paramount wanted to do a concert movie like Eddie Murphy, Raw.
Oh.
And so I said, rather than a concert movie, how about a real movie? I'll use the same budget. You know, it was like a $1 million budget, something like that. And so then I shot Still Smoking with that. Wrote it and shot it and made a ton of money. First time Prince's movie music was used in a movie. Delirium. Really? Yeah, first time. So we broke a lot of one of my things that I learned, like in next movie, for instance, there was a cameraman, King Baggett. He'd been a cameraman for a lot of major pictures, and he wanted to move up to become a DP, director of photography. Mm-hmm. And so he asked me if he could do it with my movie. And I said, absolutely. You know, you'd be the DP. And what I learned is that when you give people a shot, you know, you're getting more than just their talent. You know, you're getting their heart and soul, because they have to make a go of it. This is their first shot. And so King and I, when we did next movie, King and I, we broke the record. We had something like 42 setups in the first day.
Oh, really? Oh, geez.
Usually, if you got one, two, whatever, because you're easing in, you know, it's going to be a long haul. But with me, it was never... I never looked at it like a long haul. It was like one day at a time. And every day you shot as much as you could that you needed, you know? And so there was not, that was the thing is about script writers and that, you know, they like to write things that are going to keep them in the movie making process, keep a job, in other words. So it's not really, And with us being the actors and the comedians, we just want to get the joke on the screen,
yeah.
You know, and they get the humor, get the laughter out there. You know, that's all we care about. And so that's why the only criticism I got was that all the movies was just Cheech and Chong. You know, you just had Cheech and Chong, and then I used my wife and Cheech's wife in all the movies and that kind of led to the Cheech and Chong breakup, because Cheech really didn't like Howard. Mm-hmm. And I think what it was, he didn't like the fact that Howard came in between us.
Gotcha.
All the way he never really did. You know, Cheech always understood Lou and liked Lou. And in fact, he worked with Lou after this whole thing. I never did. Mm-hmm. You can screw me once, that's it, you know.
Yeah,
but Cheech, that does matter. You know, it didn't matter with him. And even the first movie that it ended up being Up in Smoke, the one that I was working on was called Jack and the Weedstock. And it was about that story about Jack and the Weedstock. And it was, and I thought it was okay, but nothing compared to Up in Smoke, obviously. You know.
Did you guys, yeah, I noticed on IMDb, Lou is credited as director for Up in Smoke, but then your name is there and it says uncredited. So you're there, but it's like they acknowledged you, but they couldn't, I don't know. They couldn't.
No, it's legal. It's a legal term. You know, he was the director, but I was the uncredited director. Yeah. Hey, it was crazy. I feel sorry for Lou because it was such a miscalculation that money means everything.
Yeah.
Lou's got he had a club, the Roxy, Top of the Rocks. And it was for all the high rollers and, you know, his friends and everything else. And they had matches that said, living well is the best revenge. And I thought, wow, that's really not a good slogan. Because the word revenge.
Yeah. How about just living well? Just live it well. Doesn't have to be revengeful.
What I see when he says that is that being a funny-looking little Jewish guy is sort of ignored unless he has a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then he has a lot of money, then all of a sudden everybody wants a piece of him, especially the ladies, you know, because Lou has something like about 7-8 kids by 7 different women, you know, and they're all gorgeous, all models and all beautiful, mm-hmm. beautiful girls, you know. But that was, that whole, and when he got his club too, you know, because I'd been in the nightclub business, you know, a couple of things, and I thought for sure I was going to be invited in for, you know, if nothing else, but like an advisor or something, you know. But then I realized, you know, there was this hierarchy, you know. Jack Nicholson, Lou, and Rolling Stones, and you know, the Beatles. You know, there's a whole hierarchy up there. And Cheech and Chong, we were the new kids on the block, but we were respected by all those guys, you know, for what we did, you know. And it was because that kind of fame is so short-lived.
Right.
You know, it's like a style. You know, once it goes out of style, you know, if you wait a long time, it'll come back in style.
Yeah. Were you respected by Hollywood? Did they see you as a novelty act, or did they say, oh, these guys are really funny?
Well, Hollywood is more, it's more of a, there's a lot of jealousy.
Yeah. You know?
And it was more like Warren Beatty once said to us, he met us when we're like looking for a gig, you know, what to do. And we're walking, we're on the lot, I guess it was Paramount lot. One of the, anyway, Warren came up in his car, and that's when he was, you know, at the top of his game. You know?
Right.
And he told us, he said, you guys have no idea what you've done. Now, I understood what he meant. Cheech took it a little bit too, I don't know, too literal or something. But what he's saying that we had no idea how hard it is to do a hit movie.
Yeah.
Like that. A perfect hit movie. Low budget. Everything perfect in it. The casting, the writing, everything is perfect. There's nothing you can, you know, criticize about it. You know, the way it looks, the way it ran, how long it ran, everything else, you know. Because when we started screening it after I put the Tommy Chong ending in, the crowds were just going nuts. We saved the drive-in movie theater industry, literally, because
people could smoke it.
They would show up and smoke every Sunday night, midnight showing, for years.
Yeah,
and for years they get packed. They packed it in. Now they paid it didn't cost them anything, and so everything that came in was theirs. It was all gravy, you know. Yeah, we got a little. I guess the movie company or Lou Adler got a little taste of the box office and that, you know, but But when you have a hit movie like that, there's so many people depending on you, mm-hmm. you know, that live off that, you know, and still to this day, you know, the spirit, you know, that God is there has always been with me. And what it is, there's a faith involved, and it's biblical in a sense that the scriptures say that he will perfect that which concerns you. That means God will perfect that which concerns you. Now, the only stipulation is that you have to have a relationship with God to the point where there's no question of why we're here. Whatever we do is because everything good. And there's another scripture that says everything that God made was good, and everything that God did not make was not made. So when you think of that, mm-hmm. that's heavy.
Yeah, it is.
Because everything that is made, that God made, is good. What? Life, water, air, all good. And everything that God did not make was not made. In other words, man's imagination, that, like they say, you had to create the devil in order to have a religion. You know, you have to have something that only you can provide, you know, the Donald Trump book, you know, it's only
speaking of the devil.
Well, the thing is, there's no such thing as the devil, because there's no opposite to God. There's an opposite to everything else except God, because God is pure. Everything that God made was good, and everything that God did not make was not made. Therefore, there's no devil. There's nothing. There's lack of God.
Yeah.
See, just like darkness is only the lack of light. See, the absence of light, that creates darkness. But there's no darkness per se. It's just the absence. And that's what knowledge is, you know, is the absence of stupidity. And stupidity really is the absence of knowledge, you see.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. Now, if you live like I have with that knowledge, then there, you do have a lawyer on your side. I did have a lawyer on my side. I always have. And that's why everything I've done, it's not me. It's the power that created me. And there's no getting around it. There's no getting around it. And that's why my life, if you look at it, and no matter how you look at it, it's like, this guy, well, just his wife alone, just my wife alone. I mean, I can't think of any too many 84-year-old guys that has a wife that looks like the one he's got. This guy's got it. And the talent that she has, and my kids, same thing.
Yeah.
Ray Don Chong was doing movies long before Cheech and Chong. And she was like hobnobbing with all the directors and, you know, the heavies. And all I told her to do, and she told me one day when she was in school, "Dad, buy me a scooter." I said, "Ray Don, get a job and buy your own." And she did. She got a job at McDonald's, a commercial, 10 grand. And guess what? She never bought a scooter.
No, didn't want it at that point.
But you know what? I got a scooter now. I was given a scooter from the 70s show. And my son had it for a while when he was going to UCLA. And now my daughter, she's got a camper, Ray Don. And I gave her the scooter. So she
there got it. So she got it in the end. I'll tell you what, Tommy Chong, there has been a lot of light on you throughout your career, throughout your life. Yeah. That is the absence of darkness. There has been a lot of light. You have made so many people laugh.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the hell out of you. And I appreciate you sitting down to talk to me about everything today.
Yeah, well, my pleasure's all mine, man.
Thanks, everybody. If you like this episode, make sure to tell all of your friends and family members about it. We will talk to you soon.